ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Welcome to Medialand, your weekly look at what's happening behind the scenes and on your screens. I'm Tim Burrows.
And I'm Vivian Kelly.
This week, social media is the local news king in Australia, for better or, more to the point, worse.
But first, it's radio ratings season. It's been an audio market news bonanza this week, Tim.
Yes, Viv. It's Christmas for audio statisticians. The third radio survey results of the year, they came out on Tuesday. The monthly podcast listening numbers, they came out on Wednesday. And then on Thursday, the annual State of the Audio Industry report, Infinite Dial, was published. All of the planets aligned, Viv.
I think I prefer my December present-based Christmas than your audio statistician Christmas.
But humbug.
There is a lot to digest here in all of that. It does give us some data to have a look at, though, where we are halfway through the year with the radio and podcast battles, one of which is that the Kyle and Jackie O show, which is a breakfast program in Sydney on KISS, was syndicated into Melbourne. Some people, including yourself, believed that if anybody could do it, they could. If anybody could win over a market, it would be them because they've had such staggering success in Sydney. Now that they have a 5.1% share in breakfast in Melbourne, which is not high, do you stand by that prediction?
Why start with a success when we can start with a failure, Viv? Yeah, so the ultimate plan was for ARM Media to take that show national. That in other markets around the world has been the trend. So away from kind of city-based shows to national shows. And the argument was that Carl Sanderlands and Jackie Henderson, had the talent at connecting and with commercial radio audiences to do that. So that was the plan. An awful lot of money was spent on doing that. Many people, as you very kindly reminded me, including me, said that this was a good plan. Unfortunately, it was a good plan executed very badly in Melbourne, where the audience has clearly been somewhat alienated. You know, people who tuned in and tried it decided they didn't like the crudeness and profanities and stayed away. We've already seen the ACMA, the Australian Communications and Media Authority, rule against that content once, and I think we're going to hear more about that in coming weeks as well. So not a great start for that show in what's now year two.
There are people in Melbourne who don't like the program who say, well, surely it's going to be gone any moment now because it's not succeeding here, and they might as well just focus back on Sydney where they do incredibly well. I don't think that's the case, though, in the sense that Kyle and Jackie O are both on this mega million-dollar contract. The people who were in that breakfast slot in Melbourne have now moved over to the rival station Nova. So I think the parent company, ARN, don't have the talent to plug that hole because they've moved on and are finding success at Nova. But also, they don't have the money in the war chest because they've spent it on Kyle and Jackie O for a 10-year deal. There was a report, though, this week that talked about how many people are actually listening to radio. It's the Infinite Dial report. Was there actually anything interesting in there, Tim, or was it just radio reassuring people that there's actually someone out there listening?
Well, when you say was it interesting, I probably have to declare an interest in that I did moderate the discussion for the launch of the Infinite Dial, which was part of a commercial arrangement with my newsletter Unmade. So hopefully I didn't make it too boring. But if there was one stat that I found really interesting, actually, it was the fact that we've now passed the point where more than half of Australians, certainly in this particular report, say that they listen to podcasts. So we hit that number of 52%, which is the first time it's been more than half. And that's only just behind the situation in the US.
And one of the things that people are listening to here in particular is podcasts around the mushroom murder trial. So that has obviously been really boosting podcast numbers in recent weeks.
It absolutely has. And you know, one of the things with the monthly podcast ranker is not all of the various mushroom murder trial podcasts are actually captured in that. But we certainly saw amongst Australian-made podcasts, the ABC's version of that coverage was actually the fourth biggest podcast of the month last month. And if you look at the number of downloads, because of course it was daily, the most downloads in Australia.
Well, at the very least, it sounds like people are still listening. So there have been some big brands in the news this week, and it sent the PR machine into overdrive.
Viv, I do like a good PR crisis, and most weeks some brand faces some sort of PR crisis where they lose control of what the media is saying about them. Usually that's because of something they've either done or not done. It does seem to me, though, that there have been more than usual of these crises in recent days. And what these examples tend to have in common, and certainly these ones do, is that each of them have been accused of letting down their own customers in some way.
Letting down a customer is one way to put it when you look at IVF service, Monash IVF, which owned up to implanting the wrong embryo into a customer. And that's not the first time we've heard about that from them in recent months. This led to the resignation of CEO Michael Knapp. And then on another crisis, very soon after, sunscreen maker Ultraviolet came out swinging at consumer publication Choice, which did some SPF testing on how well these sunscreens actually protect people versus how well they say they protect people. Their co-founder, Ava Chandler Matthews, then posted a long video message on Instagram that had a fair chunk of jargon.
Obviously, I've seen all of the press about the Choice testing. And I guess I just wanted to give you a bit of an understanding of what's happened, how this could happen, why we're disputing these claims. I think, I guess my concern with this whole thing is that people now no longer trust any sunscreen. It's not just about us. It's just about, you know, knowing that the consumer can trust the sunscreens that they're wearing.
And Optus have agreed to pay a $100 million fine after it emerged that staff had been tricking vulnerable customers into signing up for services that they'd never be able to use. Optus's relatively new boss, Stephen Roux, popped up in a video on LinkedIn reading out an apology.
Hello, I am Stephen Roux, the CEO of Optus. I want to share a personal update on the announcement that we've made today about the unconscionable conduct and inappropriate sales practices highlighted by the ACCC last year. The way impacted customers were treated was simply not acceptable. It should never have happened. We failed these customers, and for that, I am deeply sorry.
Is it just me, or are both of those apologies bad? The Ultraviolet one, because perhaps she sounds quite uncertain, and then the Optus one almost sounds like a hostage video.
Yeah, it's even odder when you watch it, because he's clearly on a green screen, but you've sort of got the roofs of the Optus headquarters, I think, in North Ryde in Sydney, in the kind of background, as if he's kind of floating in the air above them. Now, I think what they were trying to do was they were obviously trying to be proactive about it, because they knew this moment was coming. It was a negotiated settlement with the ACCC, which still needs to be signed off by the courts, by the way. But they had time to prepare this. Now, I suspect that some of it was a lesson from Optus from their 2023, kind of when the network failed and the previous CEO, Kelly Bayer Rosmarin, was really criticised as being a poor communicator in that, mainly because she just wasn't that on screen that much. She wasn't communicating that much. So clearly they were trying to get ahead of it, but it didn't feel particularly sincere, I suppose.
It's a delicate balance between saying too much when the media is breathing down your neck and not saying enough, because I would contend with the Monash IVF debacle that they're not saying enough. They're an ASX listed company, which means their obligation is actually to their shareholders, their investors, in getting them a return. So they can put out all the flowery PR language they like about hope and families and love and trust and science. Ultimately, though, their key objective is to make a return for their investors. We're dealing with human life, though. You know, their previous debacle or scandal was that somebody gave birth to a stranger's baby because the wrong embryo had been implanted into her. That's a catastrophic failure. And we're not just talking about customers or clients or consumers. We're talking about real people's lives. And they haven't said enough, to my mind, to manage this media narrative and to manage their very distressed customers.
The neutral thing with a brand is not to do nothing. They have to get ahead of the story. And if the right thing to do is to say sorry, then they have to say sorry and sound like they mean it. You're listening to Medialand on ABC Radio National. I'm Tim Burrows.
And I'm Vivian Kelly.
So we're always talking about audiences disappearing onto social media. And this week we saw some more evidence of that.
Yeah, it's one of the revelations out of the University of Canberra's News and Media Research Centre's Digital Media Report for 2025.
And one of the authors of that report is former Radio National producer, Associate Professor Carolyn Fisher. And she joins us now. Welcome, Carolyn.
Hi there.
Let's start with the aspects around local news, because that feels like the problem we're not solving when it comes to media. What did we learn about how audiences and local audiences are accessing their news online these days?
Well, you know, local news, as you know, the industry is in trouble. But when we ask people about the sorts of news they're interested in, local news is always right at the top. You know, people say, yes, I'm most interested in local news, followed very closely by international news. So interest in local news, according to our survey this year, is increasing. But people are shifting to different platforms to access it. And we're seeing real growth in people accessing their local news via social media platforms. And, you know, we see the, you know, very continued gradual decline of people using local newspapers. We have seen a slight uptick, though, in people turning to the online versions of local newspapers. They haven't got a lot of choice in many places to subscribe to get local news.
One of the stats I think I saw was that about 10 years back, about 15% of people were saying that they were accessing the digital version of their local papers. Over that time, the trend's actually been down, though, hasn't it?
Yeah. No, it has. I mean, that's the thing. It, you know, the shift to online has been very slow to work for the local and regional papers. And this year, really, for the first time, we're starting to see that, you know, maybe turn around. But it hasn't been a smooth transition.
A lot of people would be seeking that information out on social media. I know that when I was in Mallacoota in regional Victoria, and you see something strange happening or you see a police operation, you immediately want to know what's happening. And unfortunately, one of the best places for that is Facebook online community groups. You know, I was searching for local news to get an accurate reflection of what was happening in this remote town, and I simply couldn't get it from a verified news source. I could get it from the Mallacoota community Facebook group, which I requested to join, and that's where all the information was. So there's certainly an appetite to find out what's going on, Carolyn, but people maybe aren't willing to pay for it, or they just want to talk to each other on Facebook about it. Is that right?
Yeah, well, what we're finding, particularly in areas where newspapers have closed down and nothing has replaced it formally, then yes, these community groups on Facebook really are filling that gap. And people do find that immediate and they find it satisfying. So you're quite right. That is exactly where it's happening. As to what type of news they're getting there, I mean, you know, yes, it is mainly, I think, local traffic, local accidents, you know, the break-in around the street. It really is that very immediate type of local news.
I would never know which night to leave the bins out if it wasn't for my local Facebook group. I suppose one of the things that did strike me about some of the data in the report, though, was that people talked about having this appetite for local news, but then when they talked about their behaviour, they were not buying their local newspaper. They were certainly not paying to read their local digital version of their local paper. So it feels a little bit like the patterns and the habits are not matching what people say they want.
Well, I mean, this is always the thing, isn't it? Particularly with survey research as well. You know, we ask people, and I think people often give, you know, the sort of the most optimistic, virtuous response, and maybe their behaviour is slightly different to that. But I think you're right. People do want to know what's going on in their local area, but do they actually want to pay for it? And also, you know, when we think about what's happened with the transition of local news from print to online. Well, let's be honest, the product is often lesser, you know, and it's, you know, it might be a tab on a page of a metro paper, and it's full of syndicated news and not local news, and the local reporter's gone. And so, you know, the attraction to actually paying for the digital version, you know, well, it's kind of been reduced.
Whenever we talk about media habits, and particularly younger people, and I ask the question, you know, where are they? I'm always told, well, they're on social media, they're on TikTok. We sort of know that anecdotally, but is that borne out in the data? Are people admitting that that's where they're getting their news from now?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And we've seen big growth in it, and particularly, you know, amongst 18 to 24-year-olds. That's, you know, that absolutely is where they're getting their news from, and we're seeing really strong growth in that area and strong growth in, you know, real appetite for short video news. And, of course, you know, that's where we're seeing the growth is on these video platforms.
One of the things that struck me about that, though, was there is a recognition that often the people they're getting this information from are people employed by the traditional news outlets who've now got a presence there. So there is, I suppose, this kind of at least a slight acknowledgement that effectively the news hasn't just magically appeared in social media. It's come from somewhere else in the first place.
Yeah, but it does, Tim, depend on the platform that you're referring to. So on Facebook, for instance, and even on Instagram and YouTube to an extent, people are mainly, you know, accessing news content generated by traditional media platforms and news platforms. Or news brands, I should say. But on TikTok, for instance, they're paying much more attention to content produced by social media influencers. So it really does vary from platform to platform.
Carolyn, any time I jump on Facebook, I regret it, particularly if I end up in a news stories comment thread. I just can't believe the apparent polarisation there is in comment threads on Facebook around news items. Do Australian audiences recognise that in themselves? Are we actually that polarised, and do we see ourselves as polarised?
Look, it's a really good question, and I will get to that, but I also want to get to this thing about the reluctance about comments on social media. Mm. We are reluctant to comment, particularly on political news, and we've seen a drop in that actually this year. We've seen actually a drop in people even wanting to talk about news face-to-face, let alone on social media. And, you know, we think that's because of the very contentious and polarising nature of the news at the moment. I mean, things like the Israel-Palestine conflict, you know, absolutely divides a room. So people are not wanting to destroy friendships and things, and so they are reluctant to talk about that on social media. But do we see ourselves as polarised? Well, no, not really. We do these polarisation charts every year, and it's really interesting, and particularly when you compare us to America, and we did a direct comparison this year. You know, when we ask the, you know, people in the survey, how do they identify, you know, on the imperfect scale of left to right, but, you know, there's not much else to really replace it yet. And so based on that and the brands that they use, we can map sort of the, you know, the polarisation of audiences in Australia. And on the whole, we tend to be rather clustered around the middle, you know, fairly centrist. And I guess we saw that in the most recent federal election outcome as well. But when you compare that, say, to the audiences in America, much more polarised. And again, I guess we see that reflected in what's happening politically there as well.
Speaking of the election and democracy more generally, what do we know about the influence of misinformation in 2025, particularly when we think about the social media platforms?
Okay, well, people are very concerned about it in Australia and more concerned about it than audiences in other countries in the survey. What we know is, we asked them this year whether or not, you know, enough misinformation content or misleading or dodgy, as I think we'd refer to it in the report, dodgy content is being removed. And overall, people think that, you know, misinformation isn't being removed readily. But that's on partisan lines too. Interestingly, people who identify as left-wing think that not enough misinformation is being taken down, and people who identify as conservative think too much is being taken down. So it's all in the eye of the beholder.
So there's distrust of the mainstream media in certain sectors and demographics. There's distrust of social media in certain sectors and demographics. And then I think there's this pipe dream fantasy that perhaps AI can come in and make things unbiased and help everybody see through the clutter and get to the facts. But AI will obviously come with its own biases, given that it's being built by humans and pulling on all our information that we've put on the internet. So how do people feel about AI being involved in the news process? Are they equally as skeptical as they are of mainstream media and social media?
I can't give you a direct comparison there, but I can tell you that we asked people about their level of comfort with news that was mainly generated by AI with just a little bit of human oversight, and news that was generated mainly by humans just with a little bit of AI assistance. And people are, you know, less trustworthy of news mainly generated by AI. However, the comfort level has increased since last year. And, you know, what we find is with most things that, you know, once you become more familiar with something, your trust in it grows. So I think as it increases and people use it more, you know, people's level of comfort with it will start to increase. But we are still more comfortable with news that is generated mainly by humans.
And it did strike me that, because that's obviously a new question within this annual survey. And it's at the moment, you know, just the sort of concept of AI in creating news is such a kind of open concept that it certainly struck me that perhaps the audience were answering the question in different ways.
It's very possible. We did ask specifically, though, around news personalization and specific uses of AI. So, for instance, in the generation of news summaries, for instance, or being able to convert text to audio and video and things like that. AI summaries are seen to, at the moment, the most attractive way, to be using AI in a personalization sense. But again, based on demographics for young people, one of the things they're interested in is being able to adjust the reading level of news
so
that it's more understandable. Well, you know, I guess you ask it to reduce or increase the level of ease or difficulty on the way a story is written. I mean, they think that as an option. I don't know whether that technology exists yet, but that's something that did seem appealing to young people. And that's not surprising, given another question we asked this year, which is about trust and about avoidance. And, you know, younger people, 18 to 24s, are much more likely to avoid news because they actually find it difficult to understand. And so there is it does seem to be a bit of a correlation there between their desire or their interest in some kind of personalization that does adjust, that where they, you know, can adjust the reading level, and the fact that they avoid news, some of them, because they find it difficult to understand. So there's something there about making news more accessible for younger audiences.
And forming a sort of overview of the whole report, do you think it makes the case of an increasingly media literate audience, or does it make the argument that we should be teaching it in some way?
Oh yeah, the latter. I mean, so we did ask this year about whether or not people had some kind of formal or informal news literacy education, and you know, 70% of respondents said that they hadn't had any. But again, when you look at it by age, Hearteningly, 54% of 18 to 24-year-olds said that they had some, and you know, and about 47% of 25 to 34-year-olds had. So, you know, younger generations have been exposed to that more. There are, it's not, you know, right across the school curriculum, but there are pockets of it for younger people. But there are big chunks of the community and older generations where they really don't have that type of literacy. And when it comes to being able to discern misinformation, et cetera, having verification techniques, it's super important. So there is a real opportunity here for governments and news organisations to do something. Because the thing we also know is that the people who say they have had some kind of news literacy education, well, they trust news more, they're more interested in it, they access it more often, and they pay for it. So, you know, there's good economic reasons to invest in news literacy education, not just civic reasons.
Well, it is nice to finish on a heartening point as well. Carolyn Fisher, thank you very much for joining us on Media Land.
My pleasure.
Alrighty, Viv, have you watched anything good this week?
Yes, I have once again lost sleep consuming content. This week, the Netflix adaptation of Jane Harper's The Survivors.
Everything changed that day when two young men drowned. But there was another life lost. Her name was Gabby Birch.
So it's really good to see an international streaming giant doing quality Australian content. I know that sounds like I'm setting the bar quite low in terms of my expectations of the streamers, but there has been chit chat that's gone nowhere about imposing quotas on them, and that hasn't happened. And this is just such a quality production. Whoever did the location scouting deserves a raise. It is absolutely stunning in terms of the Australian landscape almost being a character within the show itself. There's not a lot of light and shade to it. You know, if you want a laugh or a good time, anytime you think it's about to get a bit lighter or a bit funny, you're sort of thrown back into the trauma of these families that are grappling with something that happened 15 years ago and its ongoing implications for families and communities. But despite the lack of laughter, it is very, very good, and I would highly recommend it.
Now, I have a question for you, Viv. How do you feel about roller coasters?
I love roller coasters, but if you're going to tell me that they're dangerous, I don't want to hear it.
See, that's the thing. When I go on a roller coaster, I spend most of the ride thinking about how dangerous they are, and I just find myself feeling incredibly stressed and just wishing I never got on that thing in the first place, but then feeling good about it later. And I mention that because I felt the same way when I went to the movies last night. I went to see 28 Years Later.
And were you being thrown around in your chair?
I was not being thrown around in my chair. I actually found myself like physically gripping the armrests. It's a very stressful watch. So for those who aren't familiar, this is another sequel to 28 Days Later, the zombie movie where the zombies have learned to run. And, you know, this is set, I suppose if you look at the timeline, it's probably set in about 2030 in Northern England, and people are now, basically, they've gone back to medieval times, I suppose, in terms of how they're living. But there are still zombies out there. I loved it so much. It was a really great movie, stressful as it is. Where I really struggle though is I don't want to say anything about the plot because I'm so glad I went in knowing very, very little about it. So I recommend it, but I don't want to tell you too much about it.
Well, thank you for the recommendation, but I will not be watching.
Remember to follow Medialand on the ABC Listen app.
And what have you been enjoying this week, whether it be roller coasters or zombies? We would love to hear from you. Email us at medialand@abc.net.au.
Thank you to our producer, Rob Kelly. We'll catch you the same time next week in your feeds and on Radio National.
See you, Tim.
Toodle pit, Viv.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. You can discover more ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.